This is a production of Cornell University.
VA meeting, March 5th, 2008.
I thought you were promoting me on the spot.
And I guess I just retired.
I gave you a promotion.
So David Lee is Assistant Director for Transportation Mail Services and Public Relations. David, welcome. And Bill Wentz, who is the Director of Transportation and Mail Services. So thank you both for joining us here today, and we look forward to asking you lots of questions.
Well, thank you. Not been to the employee assembly in quite a while, but it's always nice to see some faces that have been around for many years also. I was going to say old faces, but I don't think they're that old. I'd also like to introduce Spring Buck. She is our, what do we call it? I call her sustainability coordinator, TDM coordinator, outreach coordinator, I think is her official title. So she does a lot to kind of reach out to various groups who have transportation issues and try to resolve them and talk to people about some of the different options that they have with the transportation program. So I thought the format today might be the director will start out and speak about some of the things, and David will catch everything I forgot to say and tell you all the other important things that I miss in the presentation, and then we'll give you plenty of time to ask those questions. I know David at the last meeting of this group, or the last time we were asked to come to the group, gave you a presentation on the transportation generic environmental impact statement. And we did not bring that presentation again to kind of bore people with it, but we are proceeding with that project. That is a 2-year effort that we have been making with the town of Ithaca, and David and I have been sequestered in editing sessions for many days, it seems like, this past month, to try to get that document completed and to the town planning board sometime in April. We've had consultants both locally and from North Carolina working on the project. It is a fairly extensive inventory of the current transportation programs that are offered within Tompkins County and at Cornell. The impact that the university will have over the next decade or beyond as its population grows and as more people commute to the central campus area here at Cornell. The numbers we are working within the TGICE in terms of population growth at Cornell were hypothetical population growth, since none of it is really for sure. So much of it depends on the economy and how the university grows, and so much of the additional commuter traffic really depends on what we do as the price of gasoline goes up and other factors influence the way we commute to Cornell. It's a really good exercise for us to go through because it helps, and we have professionals help us identify mitigation measures, ways in which we might save individuals money by getting them out of the car, innovative ways of improving services that we currently have, like carpool programs and other TDM programs. And it helps us expand our menu of TDM programs for people that may choose to come to Cornell or commute to Cornell in various ways, even if it's not 5 days a week. I think most all of us every day now, when we get up and go to get in our cars, you think about, oh, do I need gas again today? You know, is another $50 gone? If you're lucky. And some of what we need to do just to be more sustainable is think about those trips that we're taking every day. And even if we can save money by carpooling 1 or 2 days a week with a neighbor or something, we'll be doing a lot for our own pocketbook as well as the university and as well as the environment where we are. So the TGEIS effort is really good for us to kind of get our hands around all the possible mitigations that are out there and all of the impact that the university has on this community and what's going on around us. It will also identify some of our favorite intersections that we go through every day where we sit in traffic for what seems to be long periods of time, whether they're intersections with 30-second delays or 60-second delays. It seems like a long time when you're in a hurry to get to work on time. The TGEIS will really lead to our strategic transportation plan for the university, and we call that document the TIMS, or Transportation Impact Mitigation Strategies, a long name for just saying these are the type of programs and these are the type of improvements that we want to make on campus over the next 10 years. And we've been slow on getting these documents out because, as many of you know, there is a campus master plan for the Ithaca campus in process. And we wanted to make sure these documents all really worked well together. So it would have been foolish to get the transportation piece out in advance of the master plan document. And in fact, I think the trustees are dealing with a resolution on the master plan tomorrow here at the meeting. Donna has it all ready for them, I know.
It's all ready.
So we've been working together with the campus master plan, and the transportation element of that master plan is a fairly big one. How will the campus grow in the next 40 to 50 years? While the actual generic environmental impact statement covers a 10-year period, and the TIMS document, the actual strategies that we're following, really is something that will have a good handle on what we're going to do for the next 5 years, and we expect we would update that document every 5 years as we move forward. At the same time, there are an awful lot of sustainability efforts going on campus. And I know I saw at least a half a dozen of you the other day at the Duffield Atrium when President Scorton came to speak. And we're heavily involved in that effort. David is on the President's Climate Commitment Task Force.
Implementation Committee.
There we go. And we have been working on some efforts. And let me ask, did anybody hear a couple or at least one of the transportation initiatives that the President mentioned the other day? Can anybody tell me one that he mentioned the other day related to transportation? All right, I won't put anybody on the spot because I know who you were that were there. So, but I think we were all watching the food at that point in time. But some of the things that the President mentioned the other day, I think he said by next fall we hope to have many of you commuting by vans and in van pools. And we're working on a van pool program, which would be very new to upstate New York. The only other place in New York State that has a van pool program is down on Long Island. And there are van pools established throughout this country, but New York State has been a tough state for companies to come in and offer van pool programs in because of our insurance regulations. And I think New York has a history of making it difficult for people with vehicle insurance. I think some of you may have even realized there was a time you weren't able to lease a car in New York State because of insurance difficulties. And we are having the same problem with insurance with the Ithaca Car Share program that we had hoped to launch this past fall. And I think we have overcome the major insurance hurdles for both of these programs, and we are hoping that Ithaca Car Share can be launched this summer, as well as a vanpool program. Now, vanpool program is, to me, the next best thing to public transit, especially for people who live in areas where public transit would never be possible. I mean, public transit is very dependent on people living in an urbanized area that is fairly dense, and that's not all of Tompkins County, and that's not where 25% of our employee commuters who come from outside Tompkins County live either. You know, Ithaca, the city of Ithaca is the most densely populated area, but once you get just a little ways beyond into the town of Ithaca and then Dryden and further beyond, we don't have the density that it takes to have good public transit. We have very limited public transit from outside, from Tioga County or Cortland County, Schuyler, Chemung, those counties where we have an awful lot of commuters that come into Cornell. But vanpools work well for people who are probably anywhere from 15 miles and beyond in a distance to where they work. And we are hoping to be able to launch this vanpool program this fall with an outside company in a pilot type program, a two-year pilot program. The company's name is VPSI. They're all over this country now. They're in Pennsylvania. They're in Texas. They're all over the place. And, you know, this would be one of the initiatives that we would provide incentives to our employees who get into vanpool. So it's a group of, I believe, six or more employees and an employee driver. And we would hope that our program here in Tompkins County would go beyond Cornell borders, but be open to anybody who works within Tompkins County and make it a community-based program. And we're talking about TCAT as being the coordinator of that program. And that's how it's done in many other communities. Our general manager at TCAT worked with a vanpool program in Charlotte, North Carolina, when he worked for the transit district in that area. One of the other sustainability efforts we're working with Mary Opperman's group is on flex time and flex place policies. One of the things that would make the campus more sustainable is if we had more flex time opportunities for people in flex place. And there's a group of us that are getting together to look at the policy. The university does have a policy, but Lynette Chapel-Williams has been doing some work looking around at other universities and other places and how we might rewrite the policy and communicate it better to the Cornell population and get that out. The less people have to drive to work, the better in terms of our carbon footprint here, and the more opportunities there'll be for. And people have had some really good ideas in the initial stages of this, because Cornell is a employer that has work locations in the form of cooperative extension in every county in the state. So there conceivably could be places like in Elmira and Syracuse where people could drive to and have access to the same type of computer network and other things that they have right here on campus. So we're looking hard at that and working with people on that, because that's an important thing in reducing traffic within the neighborhoods and around Cornell. Some of the other areas where we're working on is improving the campus and the surrounding environment for bicyclists and pedestrians. There are some multi-purpose trails around here. None of them link very well to the campus network, and there are some real opportunities for us to move those projects forward in the near future. Many of you might know of the East Ithaca Recreation Trail, which kind of runs south of the campus and through what would be the Orchards area and the area between East Hill Plaza and the campus. And that kind of stops at Game Farm Road and the Dryden Town Line. And there really is an opportunity to take that trail and use the old railroad bed and run it from there to Varna to Route 366 on beyond to Route 13, and all the way on to Freeville and Dryden. So there are some opportunities for us to make some of these things really happen that have been talked about for many years and need to happen. Within our T-Geist, we've also identified some of the real problem traffic intersections, mainly problems for safety reasons and safety reasons for pedestrians and cyclists and others very close into the campus that need improvement. And we're working with the Ithaca Tompkins Transportation Council to put together a list of projects that the university would help fund along with the municipalities and the state and others. The president announced this initiative back in October, and we expect to have a list together this spring, and the first year of funding these initiatives would begin this coming fiscal year in July 1, and we expect it to be a 10-year effort with the municipalities to leverage state and local funds as well as Cornell providing local matches so that we can get some of these intersections improved and accomplish some things there. One of the things that surprised me this morning was I walked in this morning and we had on my chair a baseline emissions estimate for commuters. Not a very sexy title for a document, and it's not really that thick, and I honestly can't tell you what the numbers mean in terms of how much carbon emissions and other emissions that the document notes Cornell commuters having. I did hear a lot of excitement on the other end of the phone when I called Andrew Eastlick, our planner, who said he was really happy with the numbers, that it looked like, from talking with our energy people, Lanny Joyce in particular, if any of you know him, that Lanny was estimating maybe commuters were about 30% of our energy use on campus, and the numbers are looking more like commuting is only about 20%, that we do such a good job already in moving people to alternatives. And in fact, because of where our students live, not many students really do drive to campus, especially undergraduate students. And our graduate students are very good users of TCAT and transit. So just shifting a little bit to the transit side of the house, the cost of gas and the cost of diesel is obviously having a big impact on TCAT service and our ability to expand service more rapidly at a time when people would like to get on the buses, and more buses if we had them. TCAT uses all of its fleet during the peak commuter hours. They have really no additional buses to provide any additional service at this point, and as a member of the board of directors, we're working to try to make our people at the state level and federal level, mainly our political people, aware of the problems we're having in terms of trying to serve the community. Likewise, the price of diesel just in the month of January and February has put about a $30,000 crimp in the TCAT budget for the first 2 months of the year. So that's not a good sign for the rest of the year and the ability for them to do more. Although we have a lot of creative ideas, it just really is going to take some good funding opportunities. And that, I think, in large part will depend on how the economy recovers and when we're able to do that. But we've had some really encouraging meetings out at TC3 with people from Tioga and Cortland County about Tompkins, Tioga, and Cortland doing some things together regarding public transit. There's never been any coordination among counties in this region. We do not have a regional-based transit authority like you have in Syracuse or Rochester or Albany here. Binghamton has its own little setup for Broome County, but doesn't go beyond either. And TCAT really has the potential to do more and go beyond the county line, which is a really important thing for Cornell University, where we have over 25% of our employees coming from outside of Tompkins County. So we're trying to encourage as best we can all possible forms of public transit to come into downtown Ithaca and Cornell. So with that, I'm going to stop and let David, who I know has a mental list here of all the things I've missed, talk some more, and then we'll open up to questions.
Just a couple of quick things. Bill was just talking about TCAT. TCAT is going to be the guest at the next TAC meeting, the March meeting of the Transportation Advisory Committee. So I would encourage any of you who have questions, specific questions about TCAT itself, get them to your EA rep to bring to the TAC meeting, where the general manager of TCAT will be there, as well as Cornell board members will be there. I mean, there really isn't much more to say about car share. I'm the president of the board of directors of Ithaca Car Share. It is another, like Vanpool, it's another community-based initiative that is growing out of a community-wide desire to reduce the reliance on single-occupancy vehicles. And it really does look like we finally have an insurance carrier that's ready to insure Ithaca Car Share. And I would see that being up and running, like Bill said, by summer. So we're really looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a great addition to the community. I mean, it allows people to come to work, whether in the city of Ithaca or on the Cornell campus, by alternative means and have access to a car to run errands during the middle of the day on a membership basis, on a trip-by-trip basis. Yeah?
I'm amazed by the way. I'm not familiar with car share, so it's sharing a car on campus so you can do errands. You come on public transportation or somewhere to campus and there's a car available in some format that you share amongst people who are
right
around campus or running errands.
Yeah. The question is basically, what is car share? Car sharing is basically short-term rentals. The cars, however, are not at one single rental agency. They're scattered throughout the community. Each car sort of lives in a certain spot. There'd be a couple spots, on Cornell, there'd be spots downtown, there'd be spots Ithaca College, and you reserve a car closest to you on the internet. You'd be a member because you have to be approved to drive one of the cars, and then you reserve the car and you can use it for a period of a few hours, to run errands. So it really does make a car available to people who otherwise might not have one available. It's great in the community with a lot of graduate students who are living on the razor's edge, of a family with one car. This gives them access to a second car without the expense of owning a second car.
It's really a perfect complement to our OmniRide program and then to a Vanpool program because, one of the things that people, why they hate to give up their car is they like to be able to get in and run to the dry cleaner or run to the grocery store during the day when they get a chance to do it. So by having the car share program and one of the incentives, say, for the Vanpool program may be a free membership in the car share program, so that we would try to make these programs as attractive as we can for Cornell employees by making sure they're good, substantial programs for the community, and of course that's why something like insurance is really an important thing for us to make sure they have.
Do you use one of these cars?
I don't think we finalized that yet because we were trying to build these fees around exorbitant insurance rates, and we've actually gotten a quote that's much more reasonable, so I'm not positive. It's probably going to be somewhere on the order of $5 an hour. Membership, there are probably going to be two levels of membership, one for low usage and one for higher. The one for higher usage would cost a little more, but your hourly rate would be lower. But those aren't fixed yet. I mean, we've got to go in and recalculate everything again. Yeah. I believe there will be an ability to do it month to month as well. So I've got very little to add. Bill was very comprehensive in covering a lot of the different areas. We want to make sure that you've got time for other questions as well. So
the only one I missed that I had on the list for David was park and ride.
Right?
Just thought you were coming. You may have heard already or hear about TCAT and doing some additional park and ride. There are park and ride lots now where you can pick up TCAT in rural communities out in Dryden and Lansing and Danby. And, I was talking about park and ride lots that TCAT uses now on regular routes, but we're talking about with TCAT the concept of having some major park and ride facilities where we have express bus service from those park and ride lots to downtown and to Cornell. So there was a survey done a while ago, and we've kind of identified five different areas that kind of ring the urban area. Somewhere out by Nice Egg having a lot, somewhere up by the hospital having a lot, somewhere up by the Lansing Malls, out by Ithaca College, and there's another location. Oh, yes, somewhere out Elmira Road by the Home Depot or that direction, and then out on the 79 corridor east of here as you go out to Slaterville and in that direction, where there would be an opportunity for people to drive that far and then get on express service that operated at the peak morning and peak afternoon hours, and then with some local bus service in between. It's a fairly big undertaking, and as I said, TCAT doesn't have the buses right now, although the good news I heard last week was that TCAT, well, we probably need about five buses for each of those routes or those park and ride lots to be successful. TCAT has been able to secure three new buses, two for new service, which this would be a new service item, and one to replace an existing bus just within the past few weeks. So we're looking to see if we can have more efforts like that and get more resources so that we can begin these things. They're all fairly expensive undertakings. As you can imagine, when the president announces a $10 million community transportation initiative, there's a lot more that has to be spent than that behind it.
I'm president of the UAW and I represent the service and maintenance workers here in campus and at TCAT. The buses that you purchase, now I've gone around and around with Joe about this, Joe Chakoff. The buses are being purchased out of California. Isn't there any way to purchase them closer to home and maybe
the,
in a larger lot, like right here in New York, Orion bus service?
Terry asked a question about.
I'm just thinking that it's going to be cheaper money in the long run, like having them come from California.
So Terry asked a question about why are TCAT's buses purchased out of California and not locally. The truth of the matter is TCAT is a very small user of buses. You know, we have 50 to 60 buses, I think, in that fleet here in Tompkins County. When New York City places an order for buses, they probably place an order for 200 buses. And when TCAT places an order, it's probably for four buses. And typically the way Tompkins County and TCAT get those four buses is New York City decides they don't need all 200 buses, they only want to take 185, and now there's 15 buses available for other systems in New York State because of the way we're funded through the state. So TCAT really doesn't have a lot of say in where their buses come or even specking their buses out the way they'd like them specced, because you can imagine with any company that's making buses, and you know most public transit is in big cities, they look at the order of 200 buses, and somebody coming in with four, we might wait four more years for that bus. So in recent years, Terry, TCAT has not been able to place an order for buses directly and spec them out the way we want it. The industry has changed so much. Even with Orion. Yeah, Orion buses, and some of it's made in Canada. Right.
But smaller buses, like this van program that you're talking about.
I don't know how those companies secure those buses.
Wouldn't it make more sense to have smaller buses in some of these rural areas?
Not really. There's a lot of debate over that. I know people always say that, but the expense and the difference in operating a big bus from a small bus is very small in terms of the amount of fuel you're using.
Okay.
The driver cost is the same, as you know,
mm-hmm.
and the maintenance cost on big buses often is better than small buses than life cycle costs. There's you know, medium duty buses and heavy duty buses, and there's been lots of studies of that. Now, some service you do need smaller vehicles, but you need the flexibility also of being able to move your and rotate your buses where you need them. So, and having one set of parts, and the more buses you have alike, the better.
I'm going to interrupt because it is 1 o'clock right now, and I want to be respectful of your time as well. We do have about a 5-minute window, but again, I don't know if that if you can stay for an extra 5 minutes.
If there's a couple other more questions,
I have a question.
Sure.
The question I have, it's nice to hear a lot of stuff that's happening in the future, but we have problems that are happening right today, and that is we have employees here who are purchasing permits to come to work and can't get spots because when they get here, they're full with construction companies who are using for their employees. They get to park for free. We have people who come to work, have to park a long ways away, no service to West Campus to get to work. There are no spots available down there, even though they are carded to park in certain areas. It's a real problem on West Campus for our people to get to work, and I know for a fact, because I had to pay a $50 ticket the other day for my son, who got a ticket being parked in the wrong place, because there's just no place for him to park. And you get here at 7 o'clock in the morning, it's still filled up. We see that construction workers have special lots designed for them. I guess what I'm asking is, why can't we get special lots designed for our employees who work here?
Well, Harry, you know, we've worked with you over the years on this. The contractors do not park on our staff lots unless they pay and unless there's space available.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The problem is, somebody must be parking on them. And
well,
these construction workers out there.
I mean, look.
That lot hasn't been turned over to us yet.
Yes. That lot is
not ours,
right,
basically.
Now, it will be come next fall.
So we're almost there.
But we're, you know, the West Campus project has taken, I want to say, 7 years at least, it seems.
Well, it's very disheartening for people
right.
who have got permits for down in that
but,
area.
But our goal is to, you know, take care of our employees and staff and faculty and then students below that, and we do not give our employee parking away to contractors, but to build buildings, they need areas to park, and we have not yet secured for us the area down at West Campus there that is parking. I think there
that's
was
Palm
a
Road.
Yeah,
there's
we
a
have
a lot of contractors that get parked out on Palm Road and then bust into sites. That's been the trend, and it's been the major effort is to keep as many of the construction vehicles off campus as possible. A lot of the others are within sites. Now, of course, the building sites, you know, take over what were previously areas used for other things. I mean, the physical sciences building going up, there's parking that is lost from the inventory permanently. There are people who are going to be parking in there on site during that construction project, but those aren't coming back.
Is that service would be offered to regular employees? If they could park out on Palm Road and be bused in, at least they would have a place to park their cars.
No, that is not, and we don't provide busing from that lot. We, you know, did try to get the contractors, and we were successful in getting all the contractors off the main campus and using those lots for our employees. If you think about the lot behind the wrestling, that was contractor parking. If you think about the lot across next to BTI, across from the Vet College, that's now staff parking, that was contractor parking. If you think about the lot near Rice Hall, that was contractor parking. We took those lots and moved the contractor parking out to Palm Road and made those lots on Central Campus available to our employees. I think there was a question behind Harry and then another woman back there. Yes.
Mine is more of a concern than a question. I am part of the Omni Ride, so I do the parking ride in North Carolina. I do Washington. And Nuttonwood, we're okay right now, but we've had some of our buses in the past, and haven't been a bus, it's been a van. And we had to fight for over a year to get an actual bus that we could ride and feel safe on. But we have buses that have issues at least. So you don't know if you're going to sit in a wet seat. You don't know if you're going to have heat in the winter some days. You don't know if you're going to have air in the summer. I don't know if it's just the luck of the draw or what it is. We never know from, I mean, like I said, just right now, as of right now, everything seems to be fine.
Can I ask you, is that one of the Tioga transport vehicles?
Yeah.
My understanding is there has been some money for new vehicles for the rural service approved, and I think it's been a matter of the county. Once again, transit service has grown fairly quickly in Tompkins County, and the funding stream from the feds and the state hasn't been able to keep up with us. You know, that's the good news, but it's not good news when you're a rider and we can't get replacement buses quick enough. They do shrink when it's snowy weather.
It's just, you know, it's really hard. You have to come on campus and find a place to park. I've gotten a ticket because I was in the one parking lot that was labeled with park, and I thought it was the last K lot. I was very excited, so I pulled into the last lot. Turned out it was an N. I got a ticket. And we talked to the guy in the next
day. Oh, what was his name? We got
to...
Okay, yeah.
So can you let people know your contact information? If they have more feedback and they haven't been able to ask a question or get feedback, can you let them know that right up front, and then we'll get Julie's question?
Spring, you want to tell them how they get to the website?
Yeah, you can email transportation@cornell.edu, or if you want to email me, that's fine. I pop up if you type in Spring pretty easily on Eudora, but my email is sdc23.
Well, that's right. We're not issuing ALOTs to temporary agency staff right now. We don't have the ability to do that and accommodate all our regular staff who have ALOT parking permits. And there were many that expired in December, and we haven't been able to accommodate those temporary people. Helen Stay does many things to accommodate those people in other areas. whether it be other areas of North Campus or elsewhere, where she can put people. But that's right. Well, it's not likely that that'll change while the construction's going on up there, and it's certainly not likely in the winter months where there's snow removal and things like that. But
can ALOT be expanded?
Not really.
Well, can you pretend to expand?
it has been expanded to its limits within the village of Cayuga Heights there, and there are wetlands on the other side of it, and there is a rather large area being developed now for a child care center right to the north of it. That is not in our plans to expand parking up in that area. Excuse me?
B-lot or O-lot?
B-lot has been expanded. It, you know, it used to be...
How about making it a free lot?
Well, let's not go there.
Thank you all for coming and participating today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very happy to hear that CCAP might be a part of that band project. I'm getting a lot of slack from my
department.
Yeah, we're going to be there.
Good.
Coming over, if I have a ticket, here you go, sir. I probably got a party ticket, by the way. I have a support.
This mic is on.
Okay. How are you doing? What's going on?
And this mic is also on, so I don't know. This mic is on.
Okay. Mary, this is your...
Well, you guys might as well, the seven of you still left, might as well move down.
Yeah, we can move forward.
I see that we're not as popular as Parkland.
Certainly not as controversial.
Yeah, we're not complaining about
that.
I'm
going that way.
I think between you and Susan and me, we triangulated them because they're not necessarily on that issue.
Yeah. Yeah, he did reach back to say we better bring this to senior staff in a couple places.
Well, I brought it already. It's just been a general.
Okay.
But the SMPC is going to go to senior division.
Yeah,
so. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Mary.
I don't normally use this, but is this on? Can you?
It is on.
It is, okay. Because I'm starting to lose my voice a little bit here, so.
Pull it in, Mary.
Pull it in.
You need to be pretty close.
You might want to use some Purell when you use this next week. We're here today. This is Andy Noel, for those of you who don't know. Andy's the director of athletics. We're here today to review the preliminary findings of the self-study group that's looking at the NCAA certification. So let me just, I'll go through this fairly quickly, and then if you have any questions, we'll go ahead and take those. What is recertification? We, NCAA, 10 years ago now, added to its requirements that all universities who participate in intercollegiate sports be certified by the NCAA as meeting their rural compliance. And so we received our first compliance, our first certification 10 years ago, and we're now up for recertification. The process of recertification begins with a pretty detailed self-study. So the university is asked to look carefully at itself, and then it's followed by a series of open forums so that the community can see what the self-study group found. Final report is submitted from the university, and then we get an external review team who comes in. So where we are now is that the university committees have now completed their preliminary findings, and we're coming around to groups across the campus to tell you what we've found. Let me just quickly go through the way that we have this organized. There's a steering committee. John Filicano, who is the vice provost, and I chair that steering committee. And then there are three subcommittees, each responsible for reviewing one of the three areas that we are required to review by the NCAA. So there is a group that looks at governance and commitment to rules compliance. That group this time was chaired by Nelson Roth, who is the deputy university counsel. Academic integrity, the chair of that is Rosemary Avery, the chair of policy analysis and management in human ecology. And the third broad area is equity and student-athlete well-being. The chair is Dale Grossman, a professor in applied economics and management in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. The full committee list for these three groups are on our website. If you go to www.cornell.edu/NCAA, you'll find all of that there. The self-study timeline, just to kind of put you in our timeline, we started this process in March of 2007. The subcommittees have been meeting really since the summer. We had our, actually since fall. We had our orientation by the NCAA in September, and the committees met from September until the end of January. They submitted their subcommittee reports to us in January. We're now seeking input through these public forums. The report will be submitted to the NCAA on May 1, and we will have a visit from a peer review team in early November. We expect the NCAA to decide on our certification by the end of 2008. So what we want to do now is just go through the three areas. Andy, I don't know if you want to do
one. Okay.
I'll go quickly through these three areas, and then we'll take any questions, and I hope you have some. So again, three areas. First is governance and commitment to rules compliance. They looked at two areas, the first being institutional control, presidential authority, and shared responsibility. And that broad area reviews responsibility for the conduct of the intercollegiate athletics programs, including actions of staff members and representatives of the athletic programs. And the second broad area is rules compliance, which assures that staff, student athletes, and other individuals and groups representing intercollegiate athletics interests comply with all applicable NCAA rules and regulations. In the first area of institutional control, the subcommittee found Cornell to be in substantial compliance with all NCAA requirements. They did identify a couple of areas for improvement. One was to update the athletics department compliance manual. That's been done. And the second was to complete a compliance review that was a couple of months late. And so the compliance reviews are done
every 4 years.
4 years. And the one that was due in 2007 has now been completed. It was completed in December. The subcommittee on also looked at rules compliance and found that we were in substantial compliance with all NCAA requirements. The one area of concern they noted was that some booster club groups, actually one booster club group, their bylaws lacked a specific reference to NCAA compliance. That's required in all booster club bylaws. That's now been changed, and their bylaws are now corrected. The second broad area is academic integrity. Academic integrity is actually at the core of NCAA's concerns, because this is where universities are required to show that student athletes are first and foremost students, and secondarily athletes. This is probably not surprising to you, not a big area of concern in the Ivy League, but in some areas like Big Ten, Pac-10, whatever all those other names are, where they make literally millions of dollars off of their sports teams, this has in some places been a concern where the athletes are athletes and their education sometimes and maybe inadvertently, maybe not so, take a back seat. We don't have that problem here. There are two areas of review: academic standards, maintaining the same academic standards for student athletes as for the student population as a whole, and academic support, making sure that the student athletes get the necessary academic support. In both of these areas, we were found to be in substantial requirement, compliance with all NCAA requirements. Recruited student athletes are held to the same admission standards, the ones set by the colleges, and they're subject to the same admissions procedures. Student athletes have to achieve the same standards as all students to remain in good standing, so we don't have a different good standing requirement for our student athletes. And our overarching academic good standing requirement is much higher than the NCAA's anyway. In our graduation rates, student athletes do graduate at a slowly lower rate than non-athletes overall, about a 4% difference. But their rates of graduation are so high, 88% and 92%, and we can explain that difference. Again, if you're looking at 1,000 student athletes, some percentage of those being seniors, then it doesn't take very many seniors not graduating in 6 years to lower that rate. A couple can lower it that 4 percentage point. And also remember that, you know, we don't, except for an occasional red shirt, student athletes here play for 4 years. And so it's a 6-year graduation rate. And so I think that has some difference, too. And the student population as a whole, spending 6 years to get your degree, has one impact. When you're a serious student athlete, spending 6 years here to graduate may have a different impact. But in any event, it's not significant. Male student athletes graduate at a lower rate. This is always amusing when you do this with the student. At a lower rate than the female student athletes, which reflects the same performance in the student body as a whole. Women students tend to graduate at a higher rate than male students. We did this in front of the student advisory, the athlete advisory council, and it just so happened they were essentially split. The men were on one side and the women were on the other, and the women were just grinning from ear to ear. An analysis of graduation rate by race was inconclusive because we have a very small cohort group. In academic support, the subcommittee found that Cornell was in compliance with all NCAA requirements. There was a proper balance between athletic and academic expectations and opportunities. There was adequate support services available to student athletes through referrals to the university-wide programs, as well as support or supplemental programs offered by athletics. And academic advising was properly assigned to the colleges. So we fared very well there. We're really pleased. In both of those two areas, we were in full compliance. The third area is without a doubt the most complicated area for most universities, and that's the broad area of equity and student-athlete well-being. There are three subheadings under this area: gender issues, minority issues, and student-athlete well-being. In the area of gender issues, the subcommittee found that Cornell was in compliance with all NCAA requirements, but they did find areas for potential improvement. One area for improvement were some of our facilities. All of the practice and competition facilities were deemed equitable. So there was an adequate place to play for all women's sports and all men's sports, and an adequate place to practice. In a few cases, the locker rooms, the training areas, or the meeting space does need some improvement. And more of the areas that need improvement are in the area of women's sports than in men's. So we have noted that as a possible, as an area for improvement. for the university. These are facilities responsibilities, so they are not just the athletics department, but in fact the whole university. And we had planned to renovate the women's boathouse in 1999, and we told the NCAA that, and we actually thought we had the money. Our donor for that got caught in the dot-com bust, and so our money slipped through our hands and his, by the way. And so the boathouse renovation was not completed. It's back online to be completed in a different way, but it was not done as we had intended. In the area, again, of gender issues, compensation for men's and women's coaches, the NCAA requires that you use the same market standing for men's and women's coaches, meaning that you place them in their market, so, in other words, people who do similar jobs. You give them the same placement in that range, whether they're coaching men's sports or women's sports, and we were found to be in compliance with that. The proportion of women athletes has grown beyond the goal set, actually, in 1999. The NCAA allows you up to 5% differential in the proportion of women athletes to the proportion of women students. And we're now at 46% of our student athletes are women. In the student population, 49% of our students are women. So we're within the range of acceptable. The committee did note, though, that if the trend continues, we do have the possibility that we will have more women students than male students in the coming years, and suggested that we plan for that through expansion of women's sports. In the area of minority issues, again, the subcommittee found Cornell to be in substantial compliance with all requirements. The area of concern that was noted is that the diversity among student athletes appears to be lagging behind the proportion of minority students overall. This is actually a particularly difficult issue in universities like Ivy Leagues, where we don't recruit to the athletics programs separately from our admissions process. So the same thing that we're very proud of in that second sub-area, our academic integrity, they are students first and athletes second, make it much more difficult to target recruitment for student athletes. And so this is an issue that is vexing, in that we can identify it but not easily identify a way to address it. We have a particular issue among Asian American and Black student athlete cohorts, where we are more substantially behind the cohort percentage in the student population as a whole. It is worth noting, however, that student athletes identify themselves in the broad category as other when self-reporting at a much higher rate than they did 10 years ago. So when you self-identify as a student, you can identify, you can check multiple races, or you can identify, choose not, you can identify yourself as choose not to identify. The way the university collects that data for all students, including student athletes, is they group those multiple check marks and the choose not to identify together. So we went from 12% of our student athletes as identifying in one of those ways as other to 25% identifying that way. What we don't know is that because we have more students identifying as biracial or multiracial, or do we have more students identifying as choosing not to identify at all? So we have to try to understand that better. And there's a general recommendation that the athletics department continue to partner with admissions to try to come up with some creative minority student recruitment strategies that would identify during our recruitment of minority students minority student athletes. The diversity of our staff in athletics has actually improved over the last 10 years, with 10% of our mid-management and 10% of our assistant coaches identifying as minorities. Two of our head coaches identify as minorities, and the subcommittee found that our diversity recruitment efforts were sufficient and in some cases actually quite stellar. In the broad area of student-athlete well-being, just to keep you in the sort of outline, three big subtopic areas. This is the third topic of the third area. So student-athlete well-being, The subcommittee found that we were in compliance. Again, this is an area where Cornell excels, just like we do in the area of academic integrity. And I actually chaired this subcommittee 10 years ago, and we found areas for improvement 10 years ago. We recommended that athletics do some things to improve in the area of athlete well-being, and I'm very proud to say that not only did they make all of those improvements, but in fact they went on much farther than we had even recommended. So the athletics academic support services are very well integrated with the university programs. This is very important in developing the right relationship of student athletes to their student experience. We don't want our student athletes held to the side and given even parallel and completely equal but separate programming. You want them integrated into the full university experience. So they've done a very good job of integrating the students into the university programs. All student athletes have access to these services. Student athletes are made aware of all the university services. And athletic training and sports medicine services are equitably provided to all student athletes in accordance with NCAA guidelines. Student athletes have the proper opportunity to provide feedback about their athletic experience through end-of-the-season evaluations and senior exit surveys and interviews. Athletics has the appropriate grievance and appeals procedures in place for student athletes. Their handbook is in excellent shape, and student athletes have opportunities to participate in athletics governance through the Student Athlete Advisory Council. So all in all, we're very pleased. We took the position that we would be harsher on ourselves than the NCAA required us to, so we looked farther than we were required to and found some areas we think we can improve on, but we did find that the university was in substantial compliance with all NCAA regulations. We will be presenting this same presentation to the Board of Trustees tomorrow. I keep thinking about that. We have an open forum on the 11th, and as I said, our report is due on May 1st. The peer review team will come in the beginning of November. Once they have both reviewed our report and reviewed the external review report, they can do one of three things. They can certify us, no hold barred, just give us a full certification. They can withhold our certification, deny it. Or they can give us a certification with conditions. You will be certified, but you need to come back to us in a certain number of months with these things corrected. And so we'll get one of those, some version of one of those three, probably by the end of the year. Okay, so Andy and I are here to take questions.
How are we compared to other lower Ivy League schools? You know that?
We're the last Ivy League to go through certification. I think
And everybody's received certification thus far in the second round, and everyone received it in the first round. And nationally, I'm not sure if I can recall one university that hasn't been certified ultimately. Some have been told you're okay in 80% of your program, but this 20% has to reach a higher level, and they get there in the time frame. So I actually don't know of one school that has
not gotten it.
Failed in being certified. And the NCAA, in their initial statement to us, we had a teleconference, they basically said, we want to work with you so that you do receive certification. It's not a situation where they're looking to make an example of a particular university and find fault and then have them be embarrassed on the national stage. If there are things that aren't being conducted appropriately, they just want to make sure that you're aware of them and then hold your feet to the fire, that you have a plan in place to fix it, and there's a date by which you promise to fix the situation. And so it really is a valuable process. And just want to make a comment about what Mary said, how Cornell is looking deeper than the NCAA requires. And the reason we do that is when you've got vice presidents and President Scorton and vice provosts and all these folks within the university involved in this, you might as well take advantage of that time and make it time well spent, and really every 10 years try to find out how can you really improve your program. And it's very good to look inside and to see what you might not be doing well enough and have other people with fresh eyes look at your program, because some of us You know, if we look at it from just our perspective, we think everything's just fine. And there's almost always something or a number of things that you can do better, and that's our approach.
Leanne, did you have a question?
First, I wanted to say congratulations on the track meet this weekend and also the basketball team.
Thank you very much. It was very exciting.
Yeah. And then my question is that if there was a denial, which that there has not been, does that mean you can't compete in the
In the tournaments? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if they were to deny certification, then you would not be eligible to compete in intercollegiate sports. Since they've never done it, we don't actually know, but I think that's the concept. They really, truly focus on getting you certified, and what they basically told us is the only time you're going to get in trouble is if you're not honest. They want you to be completely transparent, so they're not looking for the absence of problems. They are looking for places that are not being completely honest and transparent.
Not that it's going to happen to Cornell, but is it an all or nothing thing? Because you hear about schools that the basketball team's been put on probation or something, you know, it's a certain sport and not the whole athletic.
Yeah, it's different than that. Those are, as you mentioned, the term probation. Any individual sport can be on probation for doing inappropriate things. But this is a certification where it's actually the entire department, and it's really the university. It's more than just the department, because the NCAA feels that if they hold the university senior staff and board of trustees feet to the fire, then things are really going to happen that are required. If it's left up to a department, maybe their fiscal situation might limit what they can do. And the NCAA's perspective is you can't use lack of funds as an excuse for not doing something that you should be doing. And that's our, I think, our one exposure here is that we promised in 99 that we would upgrade our boathouse. And the reason why we didn't was because we didn't have the funding. And as Mary said, we thought we had it well in hand, and we didn't. So I'm imagining that when they visit in November, it's going to be absolutely crucial that we can show them something that I actually just looked at today, which are all the slides that the Board of Trustees is going to see tomorrow about our plan, our architect's plans. We have about 80% of the money raised or pledged at the moment. And, you know, there's a sense of urgency for us to get there by November, so there's no issue. Because if we didn't get there by November, they could say, well, maybe you guys will miss again.
Yeah.
And that would be an issue. So we that's our major.
If you see Andy
exposure.
And I down there, like, shoveling things out and and painting and... but what you're referring to are universities are required to disclose violations of NCAA regulations all throughout the year. And so they also have the ability to take a complaint from someplace else. If you are determined to have had a major violation, several I guess probably major violations, your sport, that sport can be placed on probation, they can be prohibited from participating in the playoffs. So when you see those sorts of things, you know, they did a bad thing.
Oh yeah, I know that.
In order for that to happen, yeah. either they didn't disclose something, or maybe they didn't know it.
Yeah, there's something called the death penalty. I don't know if you've ever heard that jargon before, but the only time I can remember that occurring was, I think, SMU's football program about 30 years ago, and they didn't let them compete or recruit for a period of time, which took their program from big time to really struggling, and then they've struggled ever since.
Yeah. I mean, just one other question. Maybe it was in there, maybe I missed it, but the analysis is part of the area that should be covered, the equity or the and/or the preferential treatment between the student athlete and the normal student. Is there any comparison to make sure that the student-athlete is being treated better in some way?
Yes.
I'm not sure if I caught that.
Yes. Yeah. When you it's actually the same continuum. So the set point is equity, that they are first and foremost being treated as student, and also being treated equitably. So where you would see, we found none of this, but the preferential treatment that they worry about are things like grade inflation, allowing athletes to take a different curriculum, you know, sort of the basket weaving type of a thing. Those are all issues that we just don't have any of those, because A, we don't have athletic scholarships, and B, we don't admit in only to athletics. There are some schools that really, really struggle with, they admit kids who sort of barely get in, and they really struggle with their curriculums. We're very fortunate. I mean, it creates other kinds of issues, you know, for us, that we don't have athletic scholarships and the like, but we don't have any of those problems. We're really proud of the fact that our athletes, the 400 club just met, what?
Two mornings ago. We had 40 athletes with a 4.0.
4.0.
And
if you've ever looked at what these athletes do during their season,
yep,
that is absolutely astonishing to me. And that's not an unusual breakfast.
The average grade point average for our athletes is about 3.0 for the men and 3.08 for our women. Our women they not only graduate at a better rate, but they're graduating with a slightly higher GPA.
The students can only participate for 4 years, right?
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when Mary was talking about that, I wanted to mention, in the Ivy League, we have the opportunity for a medical hardship. And so redshirting, and everybody uses the term redshirting, but theoretically in the Ivy League there is no redshirting. So you can't all of a sudden as a sophomore say, you know what, I'm the third string quarterback, so I'm going to redshirt this year. I'm going to practice every day, but I'll stay for an extra year, my fifth year. Every university in the country in Division I, except the 8 Ivy schools, can do that. What we do in the Ivy League is we have the opportunity for a medical, what we call it a medical redshirt. It's a medical hardship, which means if in the first 20% of the season, so if there's 10 football games, by the second football game, if you have a season-ending injury, then you can apply. And now we have a rule where we apply immediately. Even if the student doesn't stay for the fifth year, we now apply immediately to the Ivy League and do all the paperwork so that we can show that a student athlete missed that year, not totally, but missed 80% of it at least, and then the league will review it, and if they think that you haven't fabricated something, and we haven't had one of those yet in any of the 8 schools thus far, then you're allowed to stay for a fifth year if academically you need to stay for the fifth year. So you've got to, you know, the athletes that want to do this, if they just really care about that fifth year participation, they have to need the credits, or they have to have a double major, or they have to take a co-op semester in engineering or do an internship to make that fifth year. And in the case of a fall sport like football, the ninth semester really a necessity. I was watching a bowl game this year, and I thought this was quite interesting, and I couldn't believe my ears, but the announcer said that there's this terrific quarterback who had just taken his team right down the field, and they were just saying how awesome this player was. And one of the announcers said, and he's in a situation in this last semester of his college career where he only has one class, because he hadn't met all the requirements for graduation, but he had worked it out, so there was only one class left. And they mentioned how terrific he was reading the defenses and studying the game. And then the other announcer said, and the one class is billiards.
Oh.
So the guy had a lot of time to be a terrific quarterback. But that stuff is not happening, you know, with us.
In our college, we had an architect student, 50, Jonathan Moody.
Okay, yeah.
The football player,
yeah.
Who, in the fifth year, he didn't play. And people started to see him around because they would never see him before.
Right.
But because he was either in studio or practicing.
Yeah, yeah, the studio.
But
2 to 7.
He was an outstanding student.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Very high.
Architecture is our most difficult program for athletes, because the critiques happen. They used to happen between 2 o'clock and 7 p.m. And it was just serendipitous if the professor came by before practice started at 4:30 so you could get to it. Now I believe there's been a major effort to have the critique such that someone could be an athlete if they wanted to be, which is terrific for us. Because it is, what, a top two or three program in the country, and it's attractive to be number one now.
Number one.
That's great. Like nutrition. Yeah. And material science, you know.
And hotel
in Iowa. Yeah.
So,
that's terrific.
Any
yeah.
other questions for us? Before I go, I just want to mention, you know that when we have a team that goes off to a final playoff, we always try to do something from the staff. So we're putting together a banner for the men's basketball team. And we'll get to Carrie about, we're going to try to get it done a little earlier. Sometimes we do it and we're running it around the day before they get on a bus. So we're going to try to do it a little bit earlier. We'll be in touch through the EA so we can get it signed by as many people as possible. Give it to the team before they take off for wherever they're going to be.
Yeah. We did that for lacrosse, I guess, a year.
In hockey,
and it was a great surprise to the members of the team. They could not believe how much the staff at Cornell cared about their making that level of competition. So it was really neat.
And we'll let you know when the team's going to take up, because we like to have employees there with the banner, and then they roll it up and take it with them. So we'll let you know about that. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And Marilyn thought about it early this year.
Oh, that's great.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.